All right, strap in, everyone. We're going deep today. Deep into a Queen's University Pharmacology course companion guide.
PHAR370?
PHAR370, that's the one. A whole module's worth of info. Dense stuff, but good news.
Good news indeed.
We're focusing on, I'd say, the really interesting bits about drugs that interact with the brain.
In a good way, of course.
Positive.
In a good way. We're talking anxiety meds. We're talking antidepressants, treatments for neurodegenerative diseases. It's like a behind-the-scenes look at how medications actually do their thing.
Exactly. We're going to be like those miners sifting for gold. We're extracting the need to know from this mountain of information.
Finding those golden nuggets.
Yes. And hopefully sparking some aha moments for you all along the way. So let's jump right in. First up, how do those anxiety and insomnia meds work? How do they actually calm the brain and get you some sleep, right?
Well, it all comes down to this idea of excitation and inhibition in the brain, finding that balance between the two.
Right, so too much excitation and you're wired, anxious. But how do these medications actually tip the scales?
I like to picture a seesaw, right? Glutamate is one kid on that seesaw, pushing up, making neurons fire like crazy. That's excitation.
Okay, got it.
GABA, on the other hand, is the other kid pushing down, trying to calm things, you know. That's your inhibition.
I see the seesaw. So where did the medications come in? Giving GABA an extra push.
Bingo. Benzodiazepines, barbiturates, even those Z drugs for sleep, they're all working on that GABA system, enhancing its ability to, as you said, just chill things out.
But there's a but.
There's always a but, right?
Yeah.
It gets really interesting here. They each bind to different parts of something called the chloride ion channel.
So it's not a simple on-off switch. There's nuance to how these medications work.
It's like having a key ring, right? With different keys to the same lock. They all open the door.
But they're shaped differently.
Yeah, but the way they work, how they interact with the lock is slightly different.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's making more sense. So it's not just about boosting GABA, but how you boost it.
Exactly. And that's why some might be better for anxiety, some work better for sleep. The whole thing is a bit of a balancing act, though.
Right, got to think about the long term.
Always the long term. There are pros and cons, definitely some potential for misuse if you're not careful. This guide actually goes into a lot of detail about the long term effects.
Something to be aware of, for sure. You know what caught my eye? That bit about flimazenil.
Oh, yeah. Fascinating.
Benzodiazepine antidote, a specific antidote. It's kind of wild.
Like a reverse key.
Yeah.
Blocks the effects if someone, say, overdoses.
Okay, amazing. Potentially life-saving. Speaking of overactivity in the brain, what about seizures? I mean, full-blown electrical storms, right?
The guide uses that term, electrical storms, and it's a good one. Too much excitation, not enough inhibition, kind of like with anxiety, but amplified.
To the max.
Exactly. So how do these anticonvulsant drugs even begin to tackle that?
Yeah, where do you even start?
Well, they've got a few tricks up their sleeve. One is boosting GABA. Remember our seesaw. Boosting GABA is like giving that inhibition side a big old push.
Bringing in reinforcements.
Yes, but there's more. They can also block something called sodium channels. Those are like the wires carrying the electrical current. Block them, you slow down the current.
So like putting a resistor in the circuit to dampen the storm.
Perfect analogy. And then there's a third strategy, reducing glutamate release. Turning down that excitation side of the seesaw, right?
Okay, so three-pronged approach. You're boosting the calming GABA, you're blocking those electrical wires, and you're dimming that go signal.
Precisely. But as with everything we talk about, there's that balance. Delicate dance, really. Medications have side effects, and it's something to be especially mindful of during pregnancy. The guide actually goes into specifics about valproate and lamotrigine.
Two specific drugs.
Yeah, there are mechanisms, potential downsides. Worth a read, for sure.
Makes sense. Don't want to trade one problem for another, right? But here's something that blew my mind. Some of these anticonvulsants, they can also be used as mood stabilizers.
For bipolar disorder,
huh?
It's like finding a hidden talent. It really goes to show these neurological pathways, they're all interconnected. You tweak one system, and it can have these ripple effects on others.
Makes you think. How much do we really know about how these meds work? I mean, if an anti-seizure drug can stabilize moods, what else are we missing?
Great question. It reminds us that we're still figuring things out and there's a lot more to learn. But let's shift gears for a moment and talk about depression.
Okay, yeah. Depression, as the guide puts it, more than just feeling blue.
It's a heavy topic. And the science is always evolving.
It is, yeah. So how does this guide break it down?
Well, it highlights three main theories. to help us, you know, understand what might be going on beneath the surface.
I remember the first one, the anemone hypothesis, right?
Yeah.
That whole chemical imbalance idea.
The classic explanation. Although, to be fair, it's not always the whole story.
Right. There's more to it.
There is. But it's still relevant. Because a lot of antidepressants, they do work on two key players, serotonin and norepinephrine, both involved in mood regulation.
Okay, so the chemical imbalance idea might not be totally accurate, but it's still relevant because these medications are tweaking those chemicals.
That's it. And then you've got the neurotrophic hypothesis. This one focuses more on brain growth and connections.
Ah, it's all about BDNF.
Brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Think of it like fertilizer for your brain. It's essential for healthy neurons, healthy connections. And guess what? Low BDNF might be linked to depression.
So it's not just about the chemicals themselves, but the physical structure of the brain, too.
The connections, the whole network. And that's fascinating.
It is, yeah. And what was that third theory? Something about hormones, right?
You got it. The neuroendocrine hypothesis brings hormones into the picture.
Makes sense. Hormones can mess with our moods big time.
Absolutely. Cortisol, your stress hormone, thyroid hormones, they can definitely contribute to the whole picture.
Okay, so we've got these three hypotheses, chemical imbalances, brain structure stuff, and then the hormonal havoc. It's no wonder depression is such a complex beast to deal with.
It truly is. And this complexity, it helps us understand how different types of antidepressants actually target these systems,
mm-hmm.
because there isn't just one type.
Right, okay. We've got TCAs, SSRIs, SNRIs, MAOIs. It's alphabet soup.
Don't get lost in the acronyms. The takeaway is they all work in slightly different ways, right? Like using different tools for a repair job.
So each one is kind of like a specialized tool for tweaking the brain.
That's a great way to put it. For instance, PCAs, they block the reuptake of both serotonin and norepinephrine, meaning more of them are hanging out in your brain.
And SSRIs, the more selective, right? Mostly serotonin reuptake inhibition, so more targeted.
Yeah, like a laser beam focusing on serotonin.
Then there's SNRIs,
yeah.
Both serotonin and norepinephrine, but fewer side effects, right?
Compared to TCAs, yeah. It's all about finding the right tool for the job, like you said.
But wait, there's more. The guide also mentions electroconvulsive therapy, ECT. It's surprisingly effective.
For severe depression, yeah.
But inducing a seizure to treat depression.
It sounds intense, I know. But it's actually very safe, well-established.
Yeah.
And get this, ECT might actually boost those BDNF levels we talked about, remember?
Wow, so it's almost like jump-starting those brain growth mechanisms.
It is, and it really shows just how complex depression is, and that the search for effective treatments, it's ongoing.
We've gone from tweaking brain chemicals to rewiring the brain with ECT. But okay, I'm ready for the next challenge. Let's talk bipolar disorder.
All right, buckle up. We're diving into that roller coaster of moods, as they say.
Bipolar disorder. Extreme highs, crushing lows. I imagine treatment is a real balancing act.
You got it. Trying to find that sweet spot. And the guide lays out the key players in this balancing act. We're talking about antipsychotics, like haloperidol.
Wait, antipsychotics? I thought those were for, psychosis.
That's a common misconception. They can actually help stabilize mood swings in bipolar disorder. They often work by blocking both dopamine and serotonin receptors.
Ah, okay. So it's like a two-pronged approach to manage both the highs and the lows.
Exactly. And then there's lithium, a classic mood stabilizer. It's been around forever, but to be honest, we're still not 100% sure how it works.
A mystery medication. But hey, if it works, it works.
Right. Sometimes we figure out the how later. The important thing is that it's effective for a lot of people with bipolar disorder.
Wait a minute. Didn't we talk about some other meds that could help with mood swings? Weren't some of those anticonvulsants multitaskers?
Short memory. You're absolutely right. Some anticonvulsants like valproic acid can also be used as mood stabilizers.
It's like a Swiss Army knife of medications. One drug, multiple uses.
It really speaks to that interconnectedness we talked about. Medications can target multiple pathways. But of course, each med comes with its own potential side effects, so it's super important to be careful and monitor things closely.
Right. With mood disorders especially, finding the right med can be tricky.
No doubt about it. And speaking of delicate situations, let's move on to a topic that's often shrouded in sadness. Neurodegenerative diseases.
Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. Tough conditions. No cures yet, but understanding the mechanisms is key, right?
Absolutely. This guide dives into Parkinson's first, which is all about the loss of dopamine in a specific part of the brain called the substantia nigra.
I remember reading about that. It's like losing the conductor of an orchestra. Without enough dopamine, the brain struggles to coordinate movement.
Spot on. And the go-to treatment. levodopa. But it has to cross the blood-brain barrier to be effective.
That's the brain's security system, right?
Exactly. Keeps unwanted substances out. But levodopa needs a helper to get past security. That's where carbidopa comes in.
So it's like levodopa's bodyguard, escorting it safely into the brain.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
And the guide also talks about MAOB inhibitors and COMT inhibitors, all aimed at boosting the effects of dopamine.
Okay, so working with what's left. But what about Alzheimer's? That's a different story, right?
It is. It's all about amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles.
Yeah.
They lead to the loss of neurons, especially cholinergic neurons.
Cholinergic neurons. Those are crucial for memory learning, right? Losing them is like losing pages from a book.
A poignant way to put it.
Yeah.
And that's why cholinesterase inhibitors like donepezil are often used. They try to squeeze out as much function as possible from the remaining acetylcholine.
Lineage control, essentially.
Trying to slow down the inevitable. And then there's memantine. It's a glutamate receptor antagonist.
Memantine. Refresh my memory. That one's not about boosting acetylcholine, right?
Correct. Think of it as trying to protect those neurons from too much glutamate signaling.
Shielding them from further damage.
Exactly. It's a different approach, but another tool in the toolbox.
Wow. These neurodegenerative diseases are truly complex. It's fascinating, but also heartbreaking. Makes you appreciate the fragility of the brain.
It really does, and it underscores just how important research is. But let's take a break from the heavy stuff for a moment. Let's talk about something we all experience, pain.
Pain management. From everyday aches to chronic conditions, it's a universal need.
And this guide breaks pain down into two main types. Nociceptive pain.
Okay, so like the pain from a burn or a cut, actual tissue damage.
Exactly. Those nociceptors specialize sensory neurons.
Mm-hmm.
They detect that damage and send signals to the brain. Your built-in alarm system, basically.
Love that analogy. But what about that other type of pain?
Neuropathic pain. That one's trickier. It's when the nerves themselves are damaged, not necessarily the tissues.
Ah, so it's like the alarm system itself is malfunctioning?
Perfect way to put it. You might feel pain even when there's no actual tissue damage.
Oh, wow. That sounds terrible. Like phantom limb pain, for example.
Exactly. Or the burning, tingling pain that some people with diabetes experience.
So how do you treat those different types of pain? I mean, if the mechanisms are different, the treatments must be different too, right?
Absolutely. This guide goes into all sorts of analgesics, which are just medications that relieve pain and their mechanisms.
We already talked about NSAIDs, like ibuprofen. They work by inhibiting those COX enzymes.
Right, and they're great for that nociceptive pain, but for neuropathic pain, they don't always cut it because it's not just about inflammation.
Okay, so for neuropathic pain, you need meds that target the nerves more directly.
Exactly. This guide talks about anticonvulsants, antidepressants, even local anesthetics.
Wow, so medications designed for one thing can be repurposed for pain management.
It happens all the time.
Yeah.
It's like you've got this toolbox full of tools, and sometimes you find that a wrench works better than a screwdriver, even if it wasn't originally intended for that specific job.
It really highlights how interconnected everything is in the nervous system.
It does. And then there's, of course, the opioids.
Yes. Powerful pain relief.
But we have to be careful with those, right? High risk of dependence, potential side effects.
Right. And we've talked about those downsides before.
It's all about balance, right? Benefit versus risk. Opioids should only be used when other options haven't worked. And always carefully.
It's a delicate balance for sure. And it makes me realize that pain management is often a team effort. Medications, physical therapy, maybe even some psychological support.
You got it. It's not one size fits all. It's about finding what works best for the individual.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground, and we're not even done yet. We'll be back soon for part two of this deep dive. Okay, brain's warmed up and ready for more. I'm still thinking about that whole anticonvulsants as mood stabilizers thing from last time.
It is pretty wild, isn't it? Shows you how much we're still learning.
For sure. Speaking of learning, this next section is all about drug interactions. And things can get, well,
a little tricky.
Tricky, yeah. Especially when you're dealing with medications that affect the central nervous system. What are we talking here? Side effects.
Side effects are definitely part of it. But it's bigger than that. Drug interactions, they happen when one drug's effects are altered by another drug, like mixing ingredients, you know. Sometimes they go well together, sometimes they clash.
So two drugs taken together could either enhance or weaken each other's effect. That sounds a little scary, to be honest.
It can be. This guide actually gives some really clear examples, like combining MAOIs with certain foods or medications. Big no-no. Could lead to a hypertensive crisis.
Okay, yeah. Tricky is an understatement. So it's not just about the medications themselves, it's how they interact with each other. And with food, potentially.
It's all connected. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so important to tell your doctor everything you're taking. Prescriptions, over-the-counter meds, even supplements.
Right, because who knew that harmless herbal tea could cause a problem?
Exactly. Your doctor and pharmacist, they're the experts in this stuff. They can help you navigate it.
Makes sense. So we're talking about the medications themselves, how they interact. But this guide also mentions genetics, right? Pharmacogenetics.
Ah, yes. The future of medicine. Using your genes to figure out how you'll respond to certain medications.
Like personalized medicine.
Exactly. It's like a blueprint for your body. Some people metabolize drugs quickly, others more slowly. And those differences can mean a drug works great for one person.
But not for another.
Right. Side effects for one, perfect fit for another. It's all about individualization.
That's amazing. Yeah. But let's talk about another important topic. Drug tolerance and dependence.
Ah, yes. Two words that often get confused.
I'm guilty of that, I'll admit it.
Happens to the best of us. Drug tolerance is when your body adapts to a drug over time, and you need more to get the same effect. Kind of like needing a stronger cup of coffee to feel that caffeine buzz.
So your body gets used to the drug.
And you need to up the dose.
Got it. And this happens a lot with medications that act on the central nervous system.
Pretty common, yeah. But here's where it gets tricky. Tolerance can sometimes lead to dependence.
Okay, so dependence is like the next level.
Think of it this way. Dependence is when your body actually needs the drug to function normally. You might even experience withdrawal symptoms if you stop taking it.
Okay. Withdrawal, that's when things get really uncomfortable.
Exactly. And those symptoms, they can vary wildly. Could be mild, could be serious. Depends on the drug, how dependent you are.
So with tolerance, you just need more of the drug. But with dependence, your body actually needs it. Big difference.
Huge difference. And it's important to remember, dependence is not the same thing as addiction.
Right, right. Addiction is about that compulsive drug seeking, even when it's causing harm.
Exactly. Addiction actually involves physical changes in the brain, changes to the reward circuitry.
And those changes can last a long time, even after you stop using, right?
That's what makes relapse such a challenge.
Okay, a lot to unpack there. We've covered a lot of ground today. Drug interactions, tolerance, dependence. Even touched on addiction, the brain is complex.
It is a marvel, that's for sure.
It is. But for all the complexity, there's hope, right? Researchers are constantly working on new and better treatments.
Absolutely. And that's what's so exciting about this field. Always moving forward.
This guide actually touches on some of the most exciting developments in pharmacology, stuff that could revolutionize the way we approach healthcare.
The future of medicine.
Okay, tell me more. What kind of cutting-edge stuff are we talking about?
Well, we've already mentioned pharmacogenetics, but there's also the development of brand new drug delivery systems.
Drug delivery systems?
Like, yeah.
Think nanoparticles, tiny little robots delivering medication right where it's needed. Microchips, even smart pills that release medication on a schedule.
Wait, hold on. So instead of just swallowing a pill that gets absorbed everywhere.
You could target the treatment, deliver it directly to the problem area.
Wow. That's incredible. That would be a game changer. Less side effects, more effective treatment.
Exactly. And what about nanomedicine? Have you heard about that?
I have, but I'm not sure I totally understand it.
Nanomedicine is all about using super tiny particles. We're talking nanometers to diagnose, treat, and even prevent diseases.
Nanometers? That's like microscopic, right? Like tiny little robots working inside your body.
It's kind of like that, yeah. These nanoparticles, they can deliver drugs directly to, say, cancer cells. They could help repair damaged tissues, even boost your immune system.
That's mind-blowing. It's like science fiction. But what about gene therapy? Isn't that really futuristic stuff?
Gene therapy is becoming more and more of a reality. It involves using genes themselves as medicine. So replacing a faulty gene with a healthy one.
Wait, so you're talking about actually editing our DNA to cure diseases?
That's the idea. It's still early days, but there's so much potential there.
It's incredible. But I imagine there are some ethical concerns, right?
Of course. This guide actually goes into some of the ethical considerations. Anytime you're dealing with something as powerful as gene editing, you have to be extremely careful.
Right, the potential for unintended consequences.
Exactly. But the potential benefits are huge. Gene therapy could really change the face of medicine as we know it.
So much to think about. Personalized medicine, high-tech drug delivery, tiny robots, and even gene editing. It sounds like the future is going to be wild.
It's an exciting time to be alive, that's for sure. And this guide emphasizes one more important aspect of that future, collaboration.
Collaboration. Okay, I'm intrigued. Tell me more.
It's about bringing together experts from different fields, medicine, engineering, technology, to work together.
Like a dream team of innovators.
Exactly. Because the challenges we're facing, they're complex. And it's going to take a team effort to solve them.
This deep dive, it's just a tiny piece of a much bigger puzzle, isn't it?
It is. And that puzzle is constantly changing, evolving as we learn more. But before we get too far ahead of ourselves.
Right, back to the present.
What stood out to you the most from today's discussion?
I think for me, it's the sheer amount of information that's packed into this one module. It really highlights how much there is to know about medications and how they affect our bodies, our brains. It's a call to keep learning, to stay curious.
Absolutely. Knowledge is power. Mm-hmm. And the more you understand about how your brain works, how medications interact with it, the better decisions you can make.
For your own health and well-being.
Exactly. Speaking of learning, ready for part three? We'll be wrapping up this deep dive with some final thoughts and takeaways.
Okay, final part of our deep dive. It's been a wild ride, honestly.
It has. From the basics to the future, we've covered so much ground.
We have. Makes you appreciate just how much there is to learn about this stuff. So this last part of the guide.
It kind of brings it all together, right? Like, what does it all mean? How do we apply all this knowledge?
The so what moment. Right. Okay, hit me with it. What are the big takeaways here?
Well, the thing that really struck me was the emphasis on, well, on change. Pharmacology is not static, you know. It's constantly evolving.
Right. Constantly learning new things about the brain, about how medications interact with it.
Exactly. And we saw that with all the talk about personalized medicine, nanotechnology, gene therapy. Those are game changers.
The future's happening right now, huh?
It is. Yeah. But with any new technology, you have to think about the implications, the ethical questions.
Okay, yeah. What kind of questions?
Well, access, for one.
Yeah.
If we're talking about personalized medicine, gene therapy, these incredible advancements, who gets access? It's expensive stuff.
Right. We don't want a situation where only the wealthy can afford the best treatments.
Exactly. And then there's the whole issue of unintended consequences. We're talking about manipulating genes, sending nanobots into the body.
It's powerful technology.
It is. So we have to be mindful. We have to proceed with caution.
It's like that old saying, with great power comes great responsibility.
That's it. Exactly. And then there's a deeper question about what all this means for our understanding of, well, of what it means to be human.
Okay, now we're getting philosophical.
Right. If we can alter our genes, enhance our brains, does that change who we are fundamentally?
Those are big questions.
They are. But I don't think we should be afraid to explore them. It's about having those conversations, thinking critically.
And being ethical in our approach to all of this new technology.
Precisely. And this guide, even though it's a pharmacology course, it subtly addresses those ethical considerations throughout. It's not just about the science, it's about the impact.
The human side of things, yeah.
Right. And that's a perfect note to end on, I think. We've delved deep into the central nervous system, explored the medications that can influence it, the challenges, the incredible possibilities.
It's been quite a journey. And I don't know about you, but I'm walking away with a sense of awe.
Awe at the complexity of the brain, right?
Absolutely. And a sense of hope for what the future holds.
For the amazing discoveries yet to come.
To everyone listening, we hope this deep dive has sparked your curiosity, inspired you to learn more.
About your own brain and the medications that can affect it.
Because knowledge is power, right?
Absolutely. The more you know, the better choices you can make.
For your health, for your well-being. So keep those brains buzzing, folks. Stay curious and keep diving deep. Until next time.
Happy exploring.